So I'd like to welcome you all to our Thursday seminar, and especially our guest and speaker, Professor Melkert from the Oriental Faculty. Just a word about several things as we get started. One unrelated thing I want to mention. On last Friday, there was a day-long seminar on text and context, or texts in context. We ran out of time at the end and had no time to discuss what we were doing. So on May 25th at 2 p.m. in the same room up at St. Anthony's, there'll be a follow-up discussion. If you weren't at the seminar, it may not make much sense, but if you were at the seminar, you're most welcome to come, and I'll have the information here afterwards. You can check with me on it. Secondly, the general idea of these seminars, in particular related to monotheism, is related to my own lectures this term on the question, is there a Hindu monotheism? Trying to problematize the issue of what are we talking about with the word monotheism? How do we apply a term like monotheism from the Western tradition and the English language to the traditions of India? And why does it matter to raise the issue of whether a tradition is monotheistic or not? And there are all kinds of biases built in the last 400 years of European history about polytheism, henotheism, monotheism, and so on. And it struck me that it's in trying to deal with the issue very, very selectively, because I only have 5 lectures this term, in the Indian context and raise some of the questions, much of the value of dealing with this topic also needs and requires of us some knowledge of how these terms, such as monotheism or even God, have been used in the great Western tradition, so in the Jewish tradition, the Christian tradition, the Islamic tradition. And therefore, I was able to pull on several kind professors of the university, including 2 who are in this room, to come and talk to us about Jewish, Christian, and Islamic views of monotheism. Not in the sense that they will then themselves make the connection and say, and this is what it means for Hinduism, or this is how it compares and contrasts, but rather to put before us thoughts and reflections about how this looks in the Islamic or Jewish or Christian context, and then the rest of us who know about India in various ways to raise and push forward the conversation, to see if we can get anywhere in terms of clarifying how we use language across cultural boundaries, whether or not terms like the one true God are useful or only controversial in an interreligious context, what we learn about Hindu and Islamic views by comparing and contrasting them, Jewish and Hindu views by comparing and contrasting, and so on. So we have 3 sessions. Tuesday, Dr. Madhavi Naveder from the Hebrew Jewish Center and has very kindly offered on Tuesday over at Campion Hall, where I give my 4 o'clock lecture, 2 o'clock on Tuesday, to talk about Jewish perspectives on monotheism. 2 weeks from today, we have George Patterson, the new Lady Margaret Professor at Christchurch. We'll talk about Christian views of monotheism and how that term has functioned, perhaps where it's most at home in the history of the modern West and the Christian tradition. And today we are extremely fortunate to have Professor Melkert from the Oriental Institute, Oriental Faculty, to come here and talk to us about Islamic views of monotheism. People tend to think, I tend to think sometimes maybe Islam is the most monotheistic of traditions. We'll learn today whether that's true or false or more complicated than that. But we have a wonderful opportunity with Professor Melkert to deal with the issue. He's a lecturer in Arabic and Islam. I'm just reading from your website. Is an expert and doing current research in Islamic movements and institutions, particularly Sufism and other renunciant movements before the Junaidi synthesis, and the life and works of Ahmad ibn Hanbal, which may or may not be explained in the hour to come, and teaches on a range of topics related to Islamic law, Islamic history, and the Quran. We'll give Professor an opportunity, 45 minutes, an hour, however much time you need, and then open it for discussion, and certainly be finished by 3:30 at the latest. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And here, should I give your handout out now?
Yes, please.
Okay.
This is mostly a few things that I'll quote, well, in common with Jews, Muslims are emphatically monotheistic. They would certainly like to be told that theirs is the most monotheistic of religions. The short 112th chapter of the Quran is said to be worth a third of the whole. In English, say he is God one, God the impenetrable. He has not begotten, nor was he begotten, and he has no equal. So this little statement of monotheism is not worth a third of the whole Quran. Monotheism translates roughly Arabic tawhid, which means more literally ascribing oneness, considering something to be one. The opposite of tawhid is shirk, which means sharing, that is, ascribing divinity to more than one creator. It is said to be the one unforgivable sin. Every other sin can be forgiven, but not shirk. Now, this said, one becomes a Muslim by testifying there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. The second half of this ritual profession doesn't have directly to do with monotheism. Muhammad is the messenger of God. But it is what distinguishes Muslims on the one hand from Christians and Jews on the other. It's been observed, if I got out a box and stood on it and started ranting about God, how bad God was in the streets of Cairo, people would think I was out of my mind. But if I started ranting about how bad Muhammad was, I'd be lynched. You could say, in practical terms, that's where the rubber touches the ground. Now, Muslims do take the second half, loyalty to Muhammad, to include loyalty and obedience to the law that was defined by the messenger of God. Now, this is not to say that Islam is characteristically orthopractic. Some people have said this, that Islam is basically about orthopraxy, not orthodoxy. It's about right action rather than right belief. Some early forms of Islam perhaps were orthopractic. Judaism is the classic orthopractic religion, of course, for which the term was coined. I remember a list from Sadia Gaon of what one does to cease to be a Jew. And it's all actions. Somebody who doesn't go to, doesn't observe the festivals, somebody who breaks the Sabbath, etc. But in Sunni Islam, it's definitely somebody who denies central dogmas, who ceases to be Muslim. But even at the level of dogma, it's not exactly monotheism that divides Muslims and non-Muslims. It's belief in the Prophet Muhammad. Jews and Christians are kuffar, unbelievers, whatever they may say about believing in one God. Muslims allow monotheism without Muhammad as a messenger only before Islam. And they would say somebody 1,000 years ago could credibly be recognized as a monotheist because Muhammad hadn't come yet. But since that time... I'd like to proceed in three stages. First, to sketch very briefly the history of Islam in the Middle Ages. Second, to address at greater length the relation between monotheism and Islamic law. Finally, to address the relation between monotheism and the law on the one hand, Islamic piety, especially mystical, on the other. Okay, what distinguishes Islamic civilization from Chinese, Indian, Eastern, and Western Christians civilizations? And the quotation in your handbook from Marshall J.S. Hodgson. In Islamic civilization as a whole, three movements can be singled out as of especially pervasive formative effect: the militarizing of agrarian-based political authority, the assertion of Shari'i legal and social relations, has to do with the revealed law, and the rise of Sufi experience and teaching, has to do with the mystics of Islam. Now, the first of these, militarization, refers to the assumption of rule in most of the Islamic world by usually Turkophone soldiers. The breakdown of civilian control began in the 9th century as the caliphs in Baghdad lost power to their own generals. It was apparently completed by the advent of the Seljukids in the 11th century, another group of Turks from Central Asia, until the advent of the great Ottoman, Safavid, and Mughal empires. The chief civilian notables of the later Middle Ages were not great landlords or bureaucrats or even merchants. They were professors of law. So when Tamerlane appeared before a city, for example, it was typically judges and professors of law who would go out and meet with him, treat for terms. It would not be great merchants. It would not be anybody with any official position in the city except professor at one of the law schools or judge. Nothing like your town councils in most of the Islamic world. Now, I would say that political authority in the Middle East passed to these warlords, largely for geographical reasons. Remember, they tried to build a Great Wall of China to cut off the barbarian steps from the civilized area to keep out the barbarians. What if they had tried to build a Great Wall in the Middle East to do the same thing, keep out the barbarians? It would have to have been much longer than the Great Wall of China. It would also have to have, would have to have been many internal Great Walls around internal desert areas. Now, with an agricultural area so much poorer than China, this is obviously out of the question. willy-nilly, they were going to be ruled by people from the steppe with superior military capabilities. Geography is also behind, I'd say, the preeminence of Islamic law, in a way. Theology is the central discipline, I'd say, in the Christian tradition. Islam would be its counterpart in Islamic. Did I say Islam? Law. Law would be its counterpart in the Islamic tradition. Chinese emperors, remember, gradually transformed the Chinese nobility into scholar bureaucrats. The point was that they would be more loyal to the center if they, first of all, had this common culture with everybody, all the other officers of the empire. And second, if they obviously owed their positions to official appointment and not to, let's say, heredity or custom. In somewhat similar way, the Abbasids, this dynasty that ruled from the later 8th century, encouraged the development of a hadith-based legal culture. So that the sons of local notables from all corners of the empire would travel about the empire, picking up a sort of uniform Arabophone scholarly culture. But the Islamic scholarly culture ended up, in the end, serving not to strengthen imperial control, as in China, but to maintain an international cultural pattern, even as the ruling dynasties came and went. Now, we have there's some famous, it was some decrees to the Frankish army, I think just after Charlemagne, were translated into French and German for the benefit of student of Frankish nobles on either side of the Rhine. So there was an important cultural divide over 1,000 years ago that's still with us today. Mm-hmm. There's no such divide in the Middle East. There are no nations in the Middle East. You do have Arabophone areas and Turkophone and Persophone areas. That's true. But countries like Iraq and Syria have a very short history, 20th century creations. Whereas France and Germany are arguably much longer, much older. But on the other hand, where France and Germany had their separate development in ways, Iraq and Syria had this common Arabophone Islamic culture that united their ruling classes. Okay, Sufi experience and teaching refers to Islamic mysticism, his third character. Now, I found it useful to define mysticism by contrast with asceticism. These are the names for two ideal types of piety proposed by Max Weber. The contrast has been developed by many others. Paul Tillich did a very good job of it. Schematically, I would say ascetical piety emphasizes obedience to a transcendent God, imposing God's will on the natural world. Tillich called it theocratic religion, in the sense of making God will. Mystical piety, by contrast, is about communion with an immanent God. It's about finding God revealed in the objects of nature. Sacramentalism is Tillich's term for it. You could say that ascetical piety is about overcoming fate. Mystical piety is about accepting it. Somebody once quoted to me one of the Presbyterian creeds. It's probably the Westminster Confession. It said, the point of life is to obey God and to glorify God and enjoy Him, or the glorification by being loyal and obedient. That's the ascetical side. The enjoyment, that's what the mysticals, that's the mystical people like. It's surprising to find that in a Presbyterian document, because one thinks of them as very strongly on the ascetical side. But on the other hand, mysticism is very difficult to disengage from Christian scripture. the larger Christian tradition. Well, asceticism is commonly used to denote a program of self-discipline and austerity. And as such, it may well characterize the practice of mystics. But that's not the sense in which I'm using it here. Rather, I use asceticism in contrast to mysticism, as have Weber and Louis Massignon and others who have given us this term. Now, similarly, of course, a Muslim need not be a Sufi for there to be distinctly mystical elements in his outlook. Neither will there be found a Muslim people whose piety is without strong ascetical elements. On the contrary, you're going to find mysticism and asceticism in every religion and every individual's worldview, but in different proportions that I think can be measured. I would fearlessly say that most forms of Protestantism are more ascetical compared with Roman Catholicism, more mystical. On the other hand, Roman Catholic, the Latin tradition, would be distinctly more ascetical than the Greek tradition. And Christianity would be somewhat more ascetical than Hinduism. I mean, who is it? Rudolf Otto wrote that book comparing
mysticism East and West?
Yes, it was Meister Eckhart and
Shankara.
Yeah. Now, Meister Eckhart is a pretty far out mystic when it comes to the Latin tradition, but he was overwhelmingly ascetical in Otto's view when compared with Shankara.
Yeah.
No, Rudolf Otto, frankly, sorry, not Otto. Meister Eckhart, his little sermon on the story of Martha and Mary. Remember that? He preferred Martha.
Okay,
he says, his argument is, Jesus says Mary has chosen the better part, etc. Well, Jesus doesn't say, hey, Martha, you're doing something unimportant. Please come here and join us. He treats her as an adept, as somebody who's already had what Mary has. Now she goes on to add service. Whereas Mary is still a beginner, so she needs to be there. Right in the circle.
So you go from mystical to ascetical in that case?
Well,
or from the
it would be easy to make Martha an emblem of asceticism and Mary of mysticism.
You do that. Okay. Yeah.
You don't.
No, I mean, no. Is that what you meant, though, that the mystical would be the starting point? You learn that, and then you...
According to Eckhart, yes.
According to
that's right.
Ascetical.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's nice. Rather than going the other way, leaving the ascetical behind and going to the mystical.
Yeah. Muslims would probably usually want it to be that way. Start with the ascetical and move to
okay.
mystical.
Yeah.
Come to think of it.
Yeah.
And for that matter, yeah. I mean, no, and you wouldn't find Eckhart or any of his contemporaries saying you don't have to worry about obedience, just meditate or something.
Right, they're always afraid of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Be ascetical first.
Yeah.
Be moral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, asceticism is the usual outlook of city people.
Can you use the word mystical and ascetical?
Yes.
Would the ascetical part be in some way similar to what the karma yoga of Hinduism would say? To do predominantly with action, the right kind of action, and the ascetical bordering on to the bliss that one gets out of devotional bhakti,
mm-hmm.
would be comparable to
yeah.
Because once you start comparing the Western
mm-hmm.
theologians say, to Shankara,
mm-hmm.
we have to look at what level we are comparing
mm-hmm.
and how those terminology reflect onto the
mm-hmm.
Hindu side.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was asking
yeah.
that question.
Yeah. No, the ascetical tends to be action-oriented.
Mm.
And ascetics will look at mystics and say, look at these indolent people, so self-absorbed. Mystics will look at ascetics and say, oh, these people are so complacent. They're diverting all their energies into externalities. Don't they realize their actual situation vis-a-vis God? They're both going to be very impressive. And then, yeah, there's a certain dynamic where both
yeah.
of them, people, there's, you get regular swings back and forth
mm-hmm.
between them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, asceticism, I was going to say, monotheism in Islamic law. Asceticism is the usual outlook of city people, artisans and traders who naturally look to making a small profit on many transactions. It's a close analogy to the moral life. whose integrity will have an effect on their livelihoods. And an honest tradesman, in the long term, will have a better life than a dishonest one. Mysticism is more likely to be reinforced from the countryside, where people depend on too many things beyond their control. Outstandingly, the weather, for them to put the main stress on steady, sober, hard work, or to think seriously about overcoming fate. Now, the relative poverty of agriculture and richness of trade in the Middle East is surely one reason why Islam there has such a strong ascetical tendency, I would say, by comparison with religions in other regions. Now, the basic theological tendency of the ascetical outlook, as has been said, is monotheism. Of the mystical outlook, polytheism. Now, why should ascetics tend toward monotheism, mystics toward polytheism? I suppose the primary reason must be that God can be obeyed at any time, in any place. In fact, must be obeyed in all times and in all places. For example, adultery is not sometimes forbidden and sometimes acceptable. It's always forbidden. Supporting one's family is not sometimes required and sometimes permissible. It's always required. Therefore, the ascetic will pay less time to pay less attention to special times and places. And maybe also the idea of a transcendent, unvarying code that one tries to live up to suggests one divine author. Finally, I wish, well, maybe we do, as people interested in psychology of religion, I suspect, but I'm very much an outsider here, I suspect that the ascetic will feel some analogy between his own continual efforts to make himself obey, to bring himself under control, and the will of one transcendent God who is over all. Mystics are much more likely to respect holy places and holy times, because sometimes one feels closer to God, and in some places one feels closer to God than elsewhere. Now, in the Christian West, we usually associate ascetic religion with Protestant sects, voluntary organizations with a high degree of equality among members. Well, here I get into, I guess, sociology a bit. It's a puzzle to me why we don't get sectarianism with Islamic asceticism and Islamic law. I mean, we've got hundreds of Protestant sects, probably, in the United States. It's because when there's a strong stress on obedience, somebody who's not, who doesn't obey quite the same way, his lifestyle is practically standing insult to the one God. So it's very quickly people break up. Also, with the ascetical outlook, there's much more stress on voluntarism. One wills to do right. Okay, one will be much more attracted to a voluntary religious organization. One wills to join this church. I'm a Mennonite myself. Well, we baptize only adults because we put such a strong stress on deliberate commitment. It seems absurd to baptize an infant who can't be making any commitment. Well, if you have a strong stress in voluntary organizations, you're going to get voluntary organizations. You're going to have people splitting off in their own little groups. Now, why don't we see this in Islam? Well, partly it's the way the law actually functions. One is religiously, one is saved, one could say, by being a member of the community. Muslims will be saved. Non-Muslims will not be saved. And the law functions practically, in large measure, just to mark out the community that saves. Wherever one goes, there will be some part of the law that one has to observe to be a good Muslim. But this will vary from place to place. Now, Egyptians are noticeably more punctilious about ritual ablutions than a lot of other Muslims. On the other hand, this concern with halal meat, I associate that more with Indians and Indonesians than Arabs. I mean, I knew lots of Arab Muslims in the United States. Nobody ever worried about buying meat in the supermarket. They worried about buying pork. That they did not want. But they didn't really think about this chicken was electrocuted, not properly sacrificed. Whereas Indonesians that I met, Malaysians, were concerned. Well, obviously in Indonesia, that's an important part of proving that you're part of this safe community, is eating the right foods. It's less important in Egypt. you know, in Egypt, nobody would sit, would go into a mosque with his left foot first. And I went to Damascus, and I see all these people going into the mosque, and they're putting their left foot first. So they're coming out of the mosque with their right foot first. You know. Horrors. But of course, just not so important to Syrians as it is to Egyptians. But this is one reason for the law to stress ritual and private life. These are the first areas where individuals would identify themselves with a community, especially in a polity comprising several communities. You always have Muslims living nearby, Jews, and usually Christians. So in practice, then, Islamic morality in North Africa probably tended toward the average just as much as Christian morality in the northern Mediterranean. Inasmuch as the law is identified with a larger community, one will not be impelled by the law to withdraw and constitute a separate community. But the demand for fuller obedience is always there in Potentia. And it's been historically a major motor of political upheaval, where people say, these present rulers are not good Muslims. We're going to set things right. Say you get the Almoravids or the Almohads taking over Spain, North Africa. The Wahhabis would be the latest example. They came storming out of Arabia in the early 19th century, almost knocked over the Ottoman Empire. They were stopped by an Egyptian army, which had European weapons and discipline. But there are many, many precedents like that. Okay, monotheism and Islamic mysticism. Now, Sufism is what we call mystical Islam. If we had a Sufi here, he would probably tell us that monotheism is the heart of Sufism, that Sufism is indeed the deepest, truest response to divine unity. He would have some historical justification. The Islamic biographical tradition tells us the name Sufi first appeared in about the last third of the 8th century. It apparently refers to the wearing of wool as opposed to cotton or linen. Why wool? There seems to have been a tradition of Christian renunciants wearing wool. It seems to have been the dress of the proletariat. One sees references to dressing like porters and shepherds. It's scratchy. It's hot in the summer, which is most of the year there. It's smelly when wet. We have hadith about that. And it's weaker than cotton and linen. It tears more easily. So people wearing wool would have been ragged more often. So it's an emblem of voluntary poverty as well. Well, the precursors to the classic Sufis of the 10th century and after, that's the Junaidi synthesis, were renunciants who underwent austerities, zuhd, devoted extraordinary amounts of time to Quranic recitation and prayer, and generally cultivated a solemn attitude toward life. Many of them were known as weepers. They would weep continually over, on the one hand, regret for the sins of the past, and on the other hand, fear of the judgment to come. We don't think of Muslims today as particularly weepy people, but one still finds weeping cultivated at Quran recitation. And Shiites, when they visit their shrines, they like to weep. Okay, from the first half of the 9th century, we have talk by renunciants of devoting oneself wholly to God, thinking of nothing but God. Muhasibi, who dies in the middle of the century, says in a book about love, "When love is made firm in the servant's heart, he has nothing left over for remembering man or jinn, heaven or hell, nothing but the recollection of the beloved." Now, this is going a little beyond these people the century before who wept over their past sins. He says, when love is made firm in the servant's heart, he has nothing left over for remembering man or jinn, heaven or hell. Now, these other guys thought it was very, very proper to weep, thinking about hellfire to come, perhaps to avoid it, just by their weeping. Better to weep now than later. Now, from this sort of single-minded devotion, it seems a short step to mystical experience. And this seems to appear unmistakably in the next generation. I think I've got a quotation there in your handout from Kharraz, who died about 30 years after Muhasibi, 35. He says, if one of them was asked, "What do you know?" he would say, "God, Allah." When he talked, he would say, "God." When he looked, he would say, "God." If his limbs spoke, they would say, "God," for his members are filled with God. Okay. This is somebody who's talking about mystical experience, surely. Or Al-Hakim Timothy. Do I quote him here? Yes. Who comes another 20 years, 30 years, it's hard to say, after Khadraz. This is his saying, peace be upon him, meaning the prophet, concerning what he related to God. Mighty and glorious is he. When I revive my servant, I am his hearing, his sight, his tongue, his hand, his leg, and his heart. So by me he hears, by me he sees. By me he speaks, by me he takes. By me he strikes, by me he understands. That is, they are my best. They have expended for me their hearts and souls, so their souls do not make me a sharer in them. So here's our word, shirk, applied to this mystic. This is a hadith qudsi, as they call it, a hadith report. It's the prophet quoting God, but it's not actually part of the Quran. It's independent of the Quran. Later in the same work, Timothy subdivides the saints into three. People of spirit, al-ruh, who are preoccupied by devotions. This would be your bhakti, I suppose. People of distress, al-karb, who weep from fear of God. And then the highest are those who have reached God's wahdaniyah, his oneness, which distracts them not only from their own works, but from God's glory and beauty. They can't even be emotionally involved. They're at such a high level. Most of the ideas of classical Sufism are found with Al-Junayd, who died at the end of the beginning of the 10th century. All that's missing in Junayd's time is the systematic training of adepts, which appears to have crystallized in the 11th century, and the Sufi order, which has a series of masters and disciples, which are clearly recognized, which crystallized in the later 12th century. Now, Islamic mystical writing was largely monist for a long time, which I think has something to do with the stress on monotheism. Here's, I think, yes, I have a last quotation there from Ghazali, who died beginning of the 12th century. He's talking about how the the only real light is the divine light. All other light is sort of more or less pale imitation of the real thing. He says, suppose the light of the mirror, the light of the moon comes through the window of a house. It hits a mirror there, bounces onto the opposite wall, bounces onto the ground. You know that what light there is in the ground is from the wall. What is on the wall is from the mirror. What's on the mirror is from the moon. What is in the moon is from the sun, for from it shines the light onto the moon. Some of these four lights are higher and more perfect than others. Each one has a known station and degree beyond which it does not go. Now, a monotheistic background seems plain here. I mean, there's really only one light, which is God's light. This is also, in a way, a means to reconcile some inequality with the natural egalitarianism of Islamic asceticism. Egalitarianism goes with asceticism because everybody has to obey. Everybody has pretty much the same rule as everybody else. Whereas with mysticism, some people are closer to God than others, so it goes easily with social hierarchy. Well, the light on the floor is what common people see. The light on the walls would be the kind of illumination that the jurists enjoy, experts in the law. The light of the moon is what the Sufis see. And then the light of the sun, that's the Godhead that nobody gets to. Now, some would say that Sufism reached its intellectual pinnacle with Ibn al-Arabi, Syrian. Well, he was originally Andalusian, ended up in Syria, who elaborated a vast monistic structure, subsuming all Islamic knowledge. He's most famously associated with the phrase Wahdat al-Wujud, the oneness of being. What this means, I take it, is that if one could, well, all being must be God's being, because if we could imagine any being that wasn't God's being, we'd imagine some power that wasn't God's power, and God would not be omnipotent. So all being has to be God's being. So if I could somehow abstract the being of this cup and contemplate the being of this cup, I'd be contemplating God. So the oneness of being. Although wujud is also a verbal noun, so it also means the oneness of finding, literally. So wherever I look, I find God. On the other hand, if we had an educated non-Sufi Muslim here, he might well tell us monotheism and Sufism are contradictory, that Sufism is an intrusion into Islam from elsewhere. And he also would have some historical justification. 8th century renunciants are continually quoted as relating the wisdom of figures from the Old Testament. Well into the 9th century, rahib, which is a word for monk, is applied to Muslim renunciants as a term of praise, not reproach. The ancient Near East was not cut off from the rest of the world. Some of our earliest mystical writings seem to show traces of many diverse influences. I quoted Hakim Tirmidhi there, a French scholar who wrote a big book about him. Thought he found traces of Neoplatonic thought in his work, Jewish Christian, Zoroastrian, Manichaean, Buddhist, and even Taoist. He came from Tirmid, which is probably Afghanistan today, or Tajikistan, somewhere around there. I should look it up. Probably Afghanistan. Anyway, a place where Indian and Chinese traditions could have met. And of course, Buddhism on its way out of India. Now, my quarrel actually would not be with finding extra-Islamic influences in Sufism. My quarrel would be thinking that Islamic law is purely Arabian, came from the middle of nowhere, way, way far away from civilization. I would say Islamic law also clearly shows the influence of especially Jewish law. It's also been argued, Roman provincial law and other traditions, that the Muslims found when they conquered the Middle East. Well, our modern educated Muslims' hostility to Sufism would not actually originate mainly in concern for the pedigree of Sufism, or even maintaining pristine monotheism. I think it would have to do, first of all, with something historical, associating Sufism with a period of Islamic weakness vis-a-vis European colonialism. I mean, from, let's say, 1100 roughly to 1900, Sufism was mainstream Islam. It wasn't off to the side. It was very normal to be a Sufi. I mean, your professors of law would probably be found Thursday evening, or Thursday evening, Friday morning, Islamic system, at their lodge, performing their ceremonies with fellow Sufis. But also, I mean, mainstream Sunni Muslims have always been suspicious of elitism, which these renunciants naturally got into. As Marshall Hudson puts it, to quote him again, the first person, Shar'i Islam required no religious athletes, discouraged any other special callings. The bold experimenter was required to show, at least externally, the face of mediocre propriety. Now, I would say this is above all because of this all-pervading asceticism of Islam, its orientation toward obedience. Moral demands are the same for everyone. So if somebody does something not required by everyone, it doesn't have to do with meeting a moral demand. It takes on the character of a stunt. Now, look what I can do. I can live on a loaf of bread for a month. Now, in the later Middle Ages, perhaps there did develop a certain amount of stunt-making as Sufism. But Sufism, I think partly for this reason, always remained a complement to the Islam of the law. Jacques Vandenberg talks about, what are his terms? Ideal Islam, valid Islam, and actual Islam. Now, actual Islam is what one can actually observe. Of course, it's going to fall short of the others. Ideal Islam is the Islam of the cities. It's Islam of the jurists. Everywhere you go, ask Muslims, what is Islam about? Well, we have the Quran, we have the Sunnah, we pray five times a day, you know, we have these obediences. Sufism would have been part of valid Islam. And what the Sufis were doing in their lodge was also Islamic, but it wouldn't be quite at the center, quite at the top. And the Sufis themselves would probably talk this way. Now, Ghazali, okay, Ghazali has the Sufis looking at the moon and the jurists looking at the walls. So he's got the Sufis higher. But he would also say, certainly, the jurist Islam is what everybody has to know. The common people, you have to have the jurist Islam for the sake of the common people on the floor. That's essential. The reason for the jurists should also be part-time Sufis, he said, because then they'll have a little bit of the authority that the Sufis have, looking not at the Godhead, but looking as closely as creatures can at God. But Ghazali was himself a major professor of Shafi'i law. Somebody did a dissertation in the early 70s in Edinburgh, looking for disciples of Ghazali, expecting to find lots of Sufis. Couldn't find a one. You find lots of people who study law under him, but no Sufis. Well, one feature of classical Sufism around Junayd was, indeed, its dismissal of extreme forms of renunciation. I mean, Junayd made it possible to be a Sufi and to pursue a trade and to support a family. The mediocrity of the law means that 5 prayers are required, more recommended. I mean, if you want to pray 20 times a day, that's great. But 5 is what you have to do. The law requires that alms go first to family members. Now, disinterested charity is recommended, but it's not required. Well, Sufi mediocrity would be ordinary membership in a Sufi order. And you're married, have a trade, carry on a normal life. Just Thursday evenings you're at the lodge. There's this thing called tawakkul, which means in Arabic dependence, complete dependence on God. In the 9th century, you got people famously were set off on journeys, having no money, no water, no food. They would expect to find what they needed as the need arose. And we're told people would go off into the desert and die this way. Well, in Junaidi Sufism, it's turned inward, and tawakkul is made a sort of psychological dependence, which doesn't require these feats of derring do, like walking in the desert with no food or water. I would say, in effect, Junaid tamed Sufism and made it inoffensive. Okay, the effect of asceticism at directing Islamic piety is evident also outside Sufism. Ordinary Muslims have long associated barakah, blessing, with saints' tombs. Veneration of persons, even of the Prophet himself in Wahhabi Islam, has long been a point of contention between Sufis and their legal-minded detractors. When the Wahhabis took over Arabia in the late 18th century, they destroyed the Prophet's tomb. They said, "You know, you don't pay your, you don't do your devotions here on earth towards a building. It's the law, it's God, it's the abstraction that deserves our devotion." And even today, I'm told there's some kind of tomb been rebuilt there, but there are guards around to keep people from praying. One of my students described how, you know, the Indians will come there and they'll sort of duck around behind a pillar and offer a prayer. The guards are always looking around, trying to keep people from doing this. Well, you've got, a conflict there, and a clear illustration of mistrust of any kind of devotion to particular places and things. On the other hand, in Egypt, whenever you go out to a little village, there'll be a cemetery. In the middle of the cemetery will be some saint's tomb, some Sufi from 100 years ago or 200 years ago, who's buried there, and they like to be buried around him. But I still, even here, I mean, saintly apparatus, as I said, the apparatus of saintly intercession seems much less developed among Muslims than among, let's say, Eastern Christians. And people don't keep pictures of Sufis in their houses the way people keep pictures of saints in their houses. To conclude, then, I would say, whereas monotheism may have highly variable effects in practice, our Encyclopedia of Religion article on monotheism points out that Roman Catholicism may be strictly monotheistic and Hinduism not. And yet, to a Baptist or a Muslim, the Hindu temple and the Roman Catholic Church will look very similar, with all these statues and candles and things. Well, I would say, if we want to see where monotheism works itself out practically, we can actually see it. It would be in the association of Islamic monotheism with this aesthetical orientation that thoroughly informs Islamic piety, which is to say everyday lived Islam.
Thank you. Wonderful. We have plenty of time because Christoph was very succinct and to the point, so we're grateful for that. And I think we have, I imagine, at least 2 things we can do. One is to probe deeper into the Islamic tradition. There may be questions that come up about how all this works out. But also to put our collective heads together in terms of what kind of light does this shed on Hindu views and practices? How, looking through the lens of Islam, how does that make us think about what we learn from the Indian context and what the contrasts are and so on. Just to start us off with a kind of general question, it seems to me that one way to take it, you know, there's a kind of a basic faith statement one could start with, you know, there is one God and God alone. But one could also have a very thick description of Allah, the Prophet, the community, the military, political, mm-hmm. collective of the state with its borders and protected mm-hmm. boundaries, with this kind of set of mystical and ascetical practices woven together. If you take the first, you know, there's simply kind of one God,
mm-hmm.
it would seem that one could come fairly close to saying that certain Hindus are monotheists.
Mm-hmm.
Although I suspect that even that, if somebody's a totally devout Krishna worshipper, let's say, even that probably wouldn't make the standard of what a Muslim might think ought to be done.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, it just seems totally hopeless that there's no way that a Hindu practice or devotional group, however much they had one deity, could possibly measure up to the rightness of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Is it primarily a fear of Indian polytheism, or a real sense that Indians have too many images of the divine, or is it simply that Indians who are not Muslim are not Muslim, and therefore they're not monotheists? I mean, it's kind of circular, but is the point that there are many gods in India, or simply that they're not following the right God in the right way, on the right path, with the right tradition? Do you have any sense about what's wrong with even a devotion to a single Hindu deity from an Islamic perspective?
I don't know, well, the history of the East there. Of course, you have your Muslim chroniclers who boast about how many temples were destroyed,
yeah.
idols just knocked down. But I suspect the main thing is they're not Muslims. Because at the same time that they're waging war in India, they're waging war in the West against the Byzantines.
Mm-hmm. So because God is like the sun that cannot be seen and reflected, there's a requirement of the path of the prophet. Sort of. You need to have the mm-hmm. prophet, because otherwise you can think that you're worshiping
yes.
the unnamed God, but
yeah.
in fact you're never able to do that
yeah.
without the guidance of the prophet.
Yeah.
And so this would, as you said, I mean, after the time of the prophet, this would apply then to Jews and Christians, as well as Hindus and Taoists and everybody
yeah.
else, that it is impossible for them to be monotheists.
Yeah, good, good. Now, there are some distinctions in Islamic law. A Muslim man may marry a Christian or a Jewish woman, a Sunni Muslim. He may not marry a Hindu woman or a Zoroastrian. So, in that way, you have some degrees of
reference.
Shiite men don't marry non-Shiite women.
Because of custom and purity and so on, or because of this, the wrong God, or all of that?
I would say, first of all, because of the wrong God. Shiites are always a minority.
Mm.
And as a minority, they're concerned with boundary maintenance more than the majority.
Mm.
So their ritual purity law tends to be stricter.
Mm-hmm.
They think about it more. You're much more likely to be invited into a Sunni mosque than a Shiite mosque.
Okay.
Mm. Shiites are forbidden to eat more things. They mayn't eat eels or shellfish, catfish. Sunni Muslims may.
Mm. I have more questions, but I'd like to open it up and try to get as many people in as possible. Yes?
This reminds me, I think, please correct me if I'm wrong, the word monotheism. Something belongs, a religion belongs to that category, depending upon the definition that the person gives. Because it reminds me of a little talk that I attended last year, Professor Ramratnam was there. So it's a discussion of what consciousness was. And there were three different people, a neuroscientist, a psychologist, and a spiritualist. And each of their definitions were completely different. So what constitutes consciousness for the neuroscientist would not constitute consciousness to the spiritualist. And that is what I'm beginning to see that monotheism as defined by Islam, no one else can be a monotheist unless you are there.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, it happens with Christianity as well. So I think it becomes very difficult to say, are Hindus monotheists? They can't unless they give up all their values and all their beliefs and take on the Islamic perspective. They can never be in the category of monotheists.
Mm-hmm.
So the very definition excludes others.
Now, I guess that Christian polemic against Judaism has never centered on monotheism.
No. Yeah.
Right? Christians would accept Jews as monotheists.
And
but
Muslims too, I think.
And presumably Muslims too,
yeah.
Yes, I mean, contra gentiles and whatever, it wouldn't have.
That's not the problem. Yeah.
That wouldn't be the problem. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right, and this is why I try to avoid arguing with Muslims, because they'll always set up the terms to decide the case beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
The other
so monotheist in the sense that they believe in one supreme being.
Mm-hmm.
Even if called by different names, the other passage is there, Ekam Sampe Pra, but this is one, but wise men call it by different names.
Mm-hmm.
Can we not call this monotheism?
Well, I mean, whom are you asking? I mean,
we expect you to
me, a hypothetical
Islam.
Muslim? Yeah.
The same point was raised between this lecture.
Well, if you're not recognizing God by the names that he's revealed through his prophet, it's worthless.
And in fact, a few passages are quoted here correspond to some of the traditional declarations. They're almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when you say, what do you know? Who say God?
Mm-hmm.
Who say God? In Luke, who say God?
Mm-hmm.
He also spoke to God.
Mm-hmm.
Drashta, Shrota, Dhrata, Vinyata, Dhyata, Sarvam Naraya. The one who sees, the one who speaks, the one who inhales, the one who takes.
Mm-hmm.
So many other things are also given there.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, the reflection of light, the sun and the moon, there are parallel passages in the Kathopanishad.
Mm-hmm.
Only one is supreme, and he alone is shining in all his splendor.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is shining after him.
Tadeva
Bhantam Nubhara Sarva, Tasvasara Sarva. There are several passages
Well, you're coming out of a long tradition of
Sort of
universalism. Muslims aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And the complete dependence on God that you referred to, and that the bhakti and prabhakti that is in the Hindu tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is correspondence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
In Hinduism, whether it is Advaita or Bhakti school of Vedanta, they all, with my limited knowledge and understanding, what I've come to realize is that they say that there is only one material and efficient cause of creation. There cannot be more than one. And if that becomes a definition of monotheism, then Hinduism is monotheism, because whichever aspect of Hinduism you look at, you always look at only one material and efficient cause of creation. So that is the universal definition that Hinduism is monotheistic.
It's okay with me, but
but that would be a big if.
That's what I'm trying to say, is how you define.
Yeah.
By defining something so that you exclude something else, you create a category.
Right. I mean, what I've been finding in my lectures, I've only done two of the five so far on Tuesdays, is that we suddenly become aware of this problem. It depends on how you define the term, philosophically, religiously, specifically. And then the immediate reaction is to say, okay, everybody can use this the way they want. And then it seems then to collapse and say, monotheism is what you say it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of like the example of Islam in a way, because there's a very definite sense of, you know, Allah and the Prophet and the community and the way of life as resisting the sense of saying, well, as long as you believe the world has one cause, then you're a monotheist. And there's a real possibility for argument, and I think we learn something from that. Madhavi, you're next.
It strikes me that if the reason why certain Muslims can vary outside of their religion, as you said, it is Judaism and Christianity, surely it cannot be because they're monotheistic religions, because otherwise they can vary as Orientalists. And I find it very interesting because perhaps it's just because of the common sacred text that they share, not necessarily their inherent belief in one
That's true.
creator God. And
That's
so
true.
In that case, it's a question. question of cultural continuity rather than any inherent religious belief.
Yeah.
And as you said at the beginning, to be part of Islam is not because you are a monotheist,
mm-hmm.
it's because you are part of Islam.
Yeah.
Community. And
yeah.
so I don't think they care if Hindus are monotheists.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just because they don't follow the law. And that's
yeah.
the beginning and the end of the conversation.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Because, in fact, the term is Kitab or Kitabi or Ahlul Kitab, the people of the book, book women you may marry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, like, Christians would be like fallen monotheists or mistaken
yeah.
semi monotheists?
Yeah.
So they have it in their book somehow, but they've misunderstood their own book.
Yeah. Errant would be the word.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's wrong with Jews?
Likewise.
So they haven't gone for Trinitarianism or anything,
no.
and they have just God, but that's because it's not connected to the prophet.
Really, that's it, yeah.
yeah.
They expunge the parts of the Bible that said Muhammad would be coming to
okay.
protect religion.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You talk to a lot of other Muslims and they'll cite parts of Sufism that sound so much like parts of Hinduism
mm-hmm.
citing here. People will tell you the story of Zakhay ibn Yaqzan, the
mm-hmm.
Robinson Crusoe character,
mm-hmm.
who never gets a prophet but is able to meditate
mm-hmm.
and reach perfect communion with God
mm-hmm.
solely through and because of this sense in which on a philosophical and physical basis the monotheistic structure eventually becomes almost pantheistic.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that sort of structural sort of arrangement that I think you get in all the religions.
Yeah, except the story of Hayy ibn Yaqzan is not, it comes in the philosophical tradition, it doesn't come from the religious.
Well, exactly, then that leads me to ask the question,
mm-hmm.
I suppose there's always an internal debate. Some Muslims will say, well, the guy quoting Hayy,
mm-hmm.
you know, what kind of Muslim is he?
Mm-hmm.
And that's an issue that always comes up when you're trying to make sense of Islam. But it leads me then to say, why do those who want to exclude, what is the prophetic revelation about? Why is that the determinant point? And again, I guess that comes back to issues of covenant. It makes me want to ask, in what way is the covenant really at the core of a certain kind of monotheism? We're talking about it in the Semitic tradition. More even in a sense than the idea of a single one God, but the idea of a one God revealing himself
mm-hmm.
to one people in one relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that revelatory, specific, historical revelation a part of the monotheism?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but I think it's important to stress, yes, we're talking about a prophet and a community through history, and you're a member of that community. The particular idea of covenant, it's there in the early tradition, in the early text, in the Quran, for example. It doesn't get developed so much. But they certainly feel strongly that they are a people, a nation. More than one revelation. Well, in a sense, there have been multiple revelations, but there's no contradiction among them.
Can I just? I'm interested in what you're saying because it's sort of coinciding in some ways with a thought of mine, which is that I think what you're saying is that perhaps what's at stake here is not so much one God, but the establishment of one people.
Yes.
Yes, that the other part of the relationship is actually perhaps more significant in the development of the tradition.
Yeah, that monotheism
yeah.
relationship in
that
rather than describing God,
yes.
anyway.
Yes.
Mm. Which would mean that people compose a notion of one God in order to keep the people together?
You could go that far,
might,
yeah.
yeah.
I mean, that's what William Blake said, didn't he? One king, one God, one law. You know, it's that binding mechanism that's provided by monotheism that is its strength historically. It's a kind of cynical take.
Monotheism means a homogenous society.
Well, you project your one God, and in so doing, and in demanding that your people follow that one God, you create a cultural cohesiveness where perhaps no cultural cohesiveness previously existed. And so it's a dark view of monotheism, because it turns theology into ideology, really. But
biologists would love it, because you said that. They said that God is constructed by human beings, then. So the biologists would take it up and say, oh, God becomes a human construct.
I think to an extent we create God in our own image. I think that, yes.
But Muslims wouldn't say that, probably.
I think they probably wouldn't. I think you're probably right there.
Jean-Marie, did you have anything?
I was just wondering about, you created kind of two sections to the point where you started speaking about leadership, and then there was perhaps a divide between mystics and what you, I think, referred to as jurist, where sometimes they were both, right? And at the same time, you describe, as far as leadership in the Sufi tradition, as, you know, people having achieved different levels as far as their understanding of the divine. Well, it's not always the case, I would say, on the side of, city life, for the common, followers of Islam. Now, how do you reconcile the fact that they can be both, and at the same time, the leadership, on the one hand, is based on the recognition of spiritual achievement, and not on the other?
Well, I would say, and my main point is that this ascetical impulse is always controlling the mystical side. These jurists always have a little higher prestige than the Sufi leaders. Prestige. Well, jurists can get things done, the Sufi leaders don't.
So when conflicts do arise, if they do arise, then they're solved simply on a recognition that the most popular aspect of Islam has to basically take over.
Yeah, every now and then somebody is made to abjure his Sufi ideas. I've never heard of somebody who had to abjure his ideas about law in order to be a better Sufi.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Is there any possibility that Islam could not have been monotheistic?
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a debate in the beginnings where there was or was it so based on what you would call it, the Mediterranean, monotheism of Christianity and Judaism? Is there any possibility that it could go the other way?
Doesn't look like it, and the Quran is pretty emphatic.
Yeah. Is that because of its biblical
base? Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
The debate among historians now, the Islamic tradition tells us the Quran was revealed in Mecca and Medina, way out there in the middle of nowhere in Arabia. There were Jews in Medina, so for 10 years Muhammad is having revelations in a city where there are no Jews, no Christians. Then he moves to a city where there are Jews. Well, the Quran is full of polemics against Jews and Christians. It seems odd that he should be arguing with Jews and Christians if there aren't any Jews and Christians around. It seems odd that there should be so many echoes of other scriptures if he doesn't know other scriptures. So some people said about 30 years ago, Gunnar Wansborough and his disciples in London, it makes more sense to see Islam as starting in the Fertile Crescent, or on the edge of it, maybe. People who are in polemic with monotheists of some kind, Jews and Christians of some kind. Not necessarily, unfortunately, Jews and Christians of kinds who still have a trace in the historical record. It's on the Jewish side. I'm so annoyed at those rabbis for not paying attention to other sorts of Judaism. But other sorts of just lost. Yes. Then as a middle position, there's emerging another critical argument that the Quran must reflect an environment where Hellenistic and Jewish and Christian ideas are very familiar. But it might have been the Hejaz. It just, there was a lot more cultural interchange between the civilized world and the Hejaz than Islamic tradition makes out.
What about this comment you said towards the beginning of the talk of asceticism versus mysticism, that asceticism is primarily an urban phenomenon, mm-hmm. and mysticism is a country phenomenon, and then you said the urban is more monotheistic and the country is more polytheistic. Did that ever work itself out in Islam, or did once it spread, so to speak? I mean, Augustine had a horrible time with the North Africans trying to get them to be monotheistic.
Yeah.
They all converted Christianity, but
mm-hmm.
had a lot of kind of their weather goes. Serious problems.
Somewhat. I mean, like, you know, I mentioned these saints' tombs you find in villages.
Mm.
You don't find those in urban neighborhoods.
Mm.
Although, I mean, somebody may find one. I just don't know. Oh, you do have saints' tombs in cities too.
Saint Tomb of Ali is there.
Yeah.
It's been the scene of
yeah, of course, a big
control
city
yeah.
grows up around it.
Yeah.
I was just wondering what were the faith practices of, I mean, it was probably a huge variety, but as well as the monotheists, it's kind of tying into your question. I'm just wondering who were the people that were being converted to Islam? What were their faith practices? What were their cults, if they were cults? Were they polytheists?
Yeah, well, they would have been many Christians, Jews, and some kind of Magians, whatever
some
the
kind of
Magians, whatever we want to call the Iranian religion.
Sorry, I don't know what that is.
Well, Zoroastrians.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I mean, Islam looks so much like Judaism. It's sort of universal, an expansive Judaism. It's hard to believe that converts from Judaism weren't very important early on. But the historical record doesn't tell us that. That is, the Islamic tradition doesn't tell us that. But one difficulty with the Islamic tradition, our texts all come from 200 to 300 years after the early events. So it's a lot of time for rewriting there. Well, I mean the New Testament, you know, you have Gospel of Mark, we'll say 65, Gospel of John, 90. After. Well, in that time, there's obviously been some spread. Gospel, Jesus and John does not really sound the same as in Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have 200 years before your first biography of the prophet, you have much more time for spread and elaboration and revision.
I'm trying to think of how this can help with this. I mean, kind of Hindu reactions or Hindu differentiations from this Islamic view. Because in some ways you could say in many Hindu communities you have worship of one God, one supreme God. You do have a sense of community. You do have a sense of right practice. You do have a tension between the mystical and the ascetic. I'm wondering if one avenue might be to think of what Professor was quoting before, the sense that no statement in language can really capture the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that even though, you know, Sanskrit's a glorious language and it can be extremely precise and extremely detailed, the Upanishadic tradition in particular always sort of says, when you've said everything you can say, there's something else, or there's some other way, there's some other name.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the question would be, is this partially the fact that either early Islam or Islam always has almost a monotheistic faith in Arabic,
mm-hmm.
as a vehicle that can say who God is, and that the language is never inadequate, the language
mm-hmm.
is always adequate. Or does that break down somewhere?
No, actually, it develops over time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first time we know that somebody said, Muhammad is the messenger of God, it's on a coin, it's written in Persian. We have it in Persian
mm-hmm.
before we have it in Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
This statement, Muhammad is the messenger of God.
Okay.
And, so early on they were a little less dogmatic about the primacy of Arabic. They tended to become more of Arabophile in the course of the 9th century. When there grew up this, in high cultural circles, a certain Persian chauvinism, you would say, we have this very long and glorious history. The Arabs were off in the desert eating lizards while we had books and palaces. So in reaction, the Arabs, well, the religious establishment, the growing Sunnism, asserted that, no, Islam is the language of God. Blah, blah, blah. But even they will always say, too, language is inadequate. I mean, the Quran says that God is merciful. Now, does that mean merciful the way a mother is merciful to her child? It can't, because God is totally unlike anything else. So when we say that God is merciful, we mean God is merciful in the way that he describes himself as being merciful. As to what more that means, we don't ask. That's the Sunni position.
But when it comes to the possibility of saying of more, the more couldn't be what a Hindu might say or what a Christian might say.
Mm.
You can never have that kind of unexpected more.
I see. I don't suppose so.
Yeah. Because just it's just not conceivable. Yeah. I'm just wondering, I mean, just on this whole theory of monotheism, whether monotheism requires a very strong confidence in the ability to say what reality is.
Mm.
The tradition that you're describing of the primacy of a certain language exists in Tibetan Buddhism, and it's understood in that tradition to be to do with the physical properties of language and the affiliation between language and vibration,
yeah.
and the creative power of vibration. And I've, you know, in my kind of pantheistic sort of way, have often thought that perhaps kind of the sense of Arabic has a similar kind of the magical incantatory qualities that language have, particularly when you chant. I don't know what could be made of that.
Muslims have always liked chanting the Quran.
Mm.
And it's there's something unmediated about the Quran itself, because it's God's own language. It's true. Although there, again, the earlier tradition was maybe a little less strict, because there are tiny textual variants in the Quran. And even today, any Muslim who's educated in the tradition would know there are 7 or 10 that are acceptable to pray by. Equally good.
Okay.
Is the Islamic God considered to be one with attributes or without attributes, beyond attributes?
Yeah. Big argument over this in history. I'm not a theologian. But these arguments always had to be carried out a little bit out of the center of things. You know, the central public institution was a madrasa where law was taught. If you wanted to study philosophy, you went to the philosopher's house, took private lessons, but you didn't do it out in public.
Looking at what's happening in the world today, without taking any sides, are we actually justified in expecting Islamic jurisprudence to accept democracy? Is there anything there that allows such a philosophy, the philosophy of democracy at all?
We have lots of Muslims working on this problem. It's hard for me to say. None of them commands a wide following yet. But what we'll see 100 years from now, I don't know.
Because one of the Islamic nations, ex-foreign minister or secretary, equivalent, said that democracy is not compatible with Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at it in terms of participation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Participatory, but not democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered about that.
Yeah. Well, okay, you know, the Mennonite statement on this is the sword is ordained by God, but short of the perfection of Christ. This is why Mennonites don't participate in politics. You recognize the legitimacy of governments, but it's not for Christians to take part in that. Well, that's the language of 16th century Latin Christianity.
Mm.
200 years later, you have the Constitution of the United States, or not the Declaration of Independence, talking about God-given rights. So.
Mm.
Well, rights, which is not part of the 16th century vocabulary, it became somehow part of the 18th century.
Yeah.
Well, who knows what's going to happen in Islamic circles in the next 100 years. Some transformation like that may well take place. I wouldn't want to predict it won't. On the other hand, it has to be a transformation.
Can I just go back to Professor's question before it gets lost about the attributes of God? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one thing that came up in our discussions related to my lectures is that if you are willing to say that God has attributes such as what, goodness or beauty or whatever, mercy, justice, whatever, mm-hmm. then you're not really a monotheist, or you're a deficient kind of monotheist if you believe in a God with attributes. Mm-hmm. And if you ultimately say God is simply God and to whom no attributes can be applied, mm-hmm. then you're a monotheist. Is there any sense in these debates in Islam that God without attributes is a purer form of understanding of God?
Yeah, the Mu'tazila is the famous sort of rationalist theological movement. They call themselves Ahl-Adli wa Tawhid, people of justice and Tawhid, a description of unity. Mm-hmm. Justice because they said God won't forgive somebody who does capital, who does very bad things, nor would God ever condemn someone who does good things. And God does not foreordain that people will do good or bad things. That would be unfair, unjust. That's justice. Description of unity, because they said all the attributes mean the same thing as all the other attributes, and ultimately he's above attributes. Mm. The Sunni response to that, the majoritarian response, is no, the attributes are real, attributes are distinct, but we don't know what they mean. So that's the way they preserved transcendence.
And it means God beyond attributes.
Would apraprata guna means that which is beyond our personal verbal description? We don't have the language to describe the attributes. Because that would be a limitation of God.
What the Upanishad is able to say. So, watch on the left from there, or after the sun, mind also comes back. Words bounce back.
Bounce back from.
So that is perhaps this one.
When I first a few months ago thought of doing my own lectures on is there a Hindu monotheism and was looking for sources on Christian monotheism, a professor in my department at Boston College said, that's a very bad idea because monotheism is actually a post-Enlightenment term, and it doesn't even fit the Christian tradition until the 17th century. And so it's it's an ism word, just like you have polytheism, atheism, and therefore it's not a helpful term for understanding what, aside from the small problem of the Trinity and how that fits in, which George Patterson will solve. George will handle that in 2 weeks from now. That even if you're talking about the one God, like Thomas Aquinas with his, the article on the one God, isn't talking monotheism. Does that make any sense to you that monotheism is a problematic word to apply to Islam, or is it just as good as any other?
Well, yes, inasmuch as, as we heard, they will define it in such a way that only their religion, maybe it's sui generis.
Whereas if you use it as a term, then I guess you expect to see multiple examples fitting under this category.
Yeah. Where Tawhid fits only Islam.
Okay. Such that Islam would not do that.
Such that Islam, I'm quite thinking that Islam would, as you said, it wants to keep the attributes. It wants to be able to say God does have characters. Goodness would have to be one of them, the names of Allah.
Yeah, but we don't know what applied to God, it doesn't mean the same thing as applied to a person.
So there's no analogy. It's the univocal meaning.
Yeah.
For a, yeah.
Is that it's a fine philosophical
yeah.
point, but maybe it's one of the places where the difference between things
mm-hmm.
and happy and funny and
mm-hmm. Is there a good dictionary of theology
yeah.
where all these terminologies like
mm-hmm.
explain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've done some of that. But sounds like the experts agree with you then.